Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow sofas are built for the way you live. With thousands of possible configurations, their five-seating collections fit any decor. From classic mid-century style to sleek contemporary design, Burrow sofas are made to last and grow with you. You can add seats whenever and easily assemble your updated sofa with no tools needed. And free shipping always? That's just the cherry on top. Right now, save up to 50% during Burrow's spring sale at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. Hey, how are you? I am sorry for the lack of a brand new episode this week. I have had some difficult news in my personal life and haven't really been able to get myself together to create a episode for you this week. But this old one is great. It's really worth a re-listen, and I hope you enjoy it. And I have already recorded next week's episode with Jan, so assuming I can get that edited and transcribed, we should be back to brand new content next week. Okay, thanks. Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I'm just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. So I am here with Laura Silverstein, who is a couples therapist in Pennsylvania and the author of Love is an Action Verb. She is certified in the Gottman method of couples therapy and works with the Gottmans on their research team. So Laura, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for inviting me here.
You are very welcome. So you're a couples therapist. How did you get into that? Was that something you always wanted to do?
It's an interesting journey. I guess everybody has their journey. And for me, I started off, I pretty much knew that I was here in the world to connect to people. I just like people. My dad was a social worker. My grandmother was a social worker. So I followed that path. And undergrad, I majored in social work. And I think I started off wanting to work with children as a family therapist. And my experience was that I felt that when the parents were really getting along well and communicating well and supporting each other, then they were able to co-parent their children in a way that was much more positive. So I sort of expanded into couples therapy, and I also I'm a Quaker, which so there's a belief in peace, and so I do feel that that's part of my mission is to help there be more peace in the world, and I'm fine having that be a very lofty goal because I think we have to have lofty goals to make a difference. And so it's just my little way of like session by session, trying to help people manage conflict and feel more connected and understand each other better.
Yeah. I mean, we can't all be Nelson Mandela, but we can try and do our little bits in our area with our people. I think that makes complete sense to me.
And I've just been so, fortunate to have amazing mentors to teach me a craft that I could, feel like I can make a difference. And also my clients, right? Like they're the ones who've taught me how to be good at my job because they know what it's like to be, themselves and they've taught me how to be a better therapist. So I'm eternally grateful.
And can you tell me a bit about the Gottman method?
Sure. So it is what we call an evidence-based approach, which means that it's research-driven, which is very important to me because if I'm giving advice, I don't want to just give it based on my own relationship. I want it to be something that there's a large sample size and lots of research. And what they did, they started off what they call the newlywed study. And it started off, and obviously it's been expanded and repeated with different populations, but couples would come back after their honeymoons and go to this little bed and breakfast that was actually a lab. So they were, the team was collecting their urine and blood samples, taking their pulse, videotaping them, interviewing them. And we got to see what couples do, sort of how they have breakfast together, in addition to just how do you respond in a couples therapy environment.
Yeah.
And they also wanted to see couples who were not in distress, couples who were expecting to stay together forever and always, and following them to see what were the similarities with the couples who stayed together, what were the similarities with the couples that separated. So that we then can learn as therapists, as helpers, how to teach people, what the experts were doing, the experts being the people who lived happily ever after, what were the similarities so that we can help people who maybe that doesn't come as naturally to help them turn the ship around, if that makes sense.
It does, because if you only look at couples in crisis, there's nothing to model. There's nothing to say, well, you could say, this doesn't work, but you don't know what to say does work.
I love that you're saying that because I 100% agree that we want to be focusing on strengths. What can we do? Like, we don't want to just decrease negativity. That's not love, right? When we feel love and close, it's the experience of the positivity of what is there. So it can't just be conflict management. That's part of what I do. Don't get me wrong. I help people learn how to fight and fight fair, but it's also how is your friendship? Are you having fun together? Do you feel warm and connected and the good stuff? Putting, making sure that you're remembering to prioritize each other.
It makes me think, I'm going to do a terrible job at telling this story because I can only remember bits of it. But there was a point in the Second World War when the British government was trying to work out the weak points on planes. And they were only looking at the planes that came back. So they were strengthening the wrong parts of the planes until somebody said, we need to look at the planes that went down.
Yeah.
To see where the weakness is. Because if we just look, they were looking at the ones that came back and saying, oh, there are, you know, there are holes in the wings and there are holes in, but they weren't, yeah, they were looking in the wrong place. And that just came to mind when you were talking.
Right. And I imagine there's a lot to learn from both, right?
Yes, no doubt. No doubt.
And so that marriage between what's working and what isn't working, constantly looking to reassess, oh, if this plane went down, why? And if this plane came back, why?
Yes.
Those are equally important questions. I love that example. Wow, that's great. I'm going to use that one.
I'll find a link about it because I think I know where I learned about it. So I will find a link and put it in the show notes and somebody could do a better job than I just did explaining it. So I expect you're asked this a lot, but does being a couples therapist mean that you are in a perfect conflict-free relationship?
No. That's awesome. So funny story, I am married to another couples therapist. So, you know, would you like to be a fly on that wall? Here's the thing, right? So I tend to feel things very strongly. I am an emotional person. And I think that's part of why I'm good at my job. I can attune if somebody's sad, I feel that with them. If they're angry, I don't shy away from the full range of emotions. But what does that also mean? That I feel things pretty intensely. So it's not easy to be in a relationship with me. And I have a lot of lifelong work to do of, you know, it doesn't happen in sessions. When I'm a couples therapist, I'm very much feeling very grounded. But in my personal life, no. Like I get angry and I break all the rules that I teach people to do. But what I will say is that we're both committed to the tools that work because we do have them. So I tell my couples, there's little booklets I have. I'm a big handout person because I personally am I'm a visual learner. So I give people a lot of like worksheets to kind of see visual representations, patterns, and those kinds of things. And my husband and I have the same worksheets in our bedside table, not because we don't have them memorized, because believe me, we do. We do this. We've both been doing this a long time. We met in graduate school. But when you're upset, that's when you need support to keep you grounded and to follow the rules and to self-correct. And it's mostly about having a repair. All couples fight. 100% of couples, not only couples, but human relationships have conflict because that's differences of opinion. But what does it come down to? And we know from the research that the difference between a relationship that lasts and one that doesn't is, do they have the capacity to repair after things go south? And my husband and I are very good at that because we believe in it. It works. So we follow the structure and then we make up and go on with our life. So it's good.
I think people expect perfection. I have a friend whose mum is a family therapist. And mm-hmm. people would say to her, oh, I bet your mum's like amazing at home. And she'd just go, no, she's really annoying. Yeah. You know, she all of the things that all of our mums did, just because she had this role at work, didn't make her a god at home, because nobody is.
And I think that's a gift to be able to share that with everybody, that, you know, so much of what brings happiness, I think, is accepting our imperfection, not striving for perfection. And when helping professionals can admit the mud on their face, it's a level playing ground that we're all just trying to learn how to connect in a world where we disagree sometimes and we let people down. It doesn't get better. We just learn how to be kinder and more self-aware as we do these things again.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So the reason I invited you to come on the podcast was I thought it would be good to look at the impact of hoarding on couples. And it's not something I've especially covered before. Partly it's come up, but it's not something I've really focused on. Partly because I'm single, and I often think about singlehood in relation to hoarding is a real double-edged sword, because on the one hand, I'm sure that being the partner of a hoarder is really stressful in a lot of ways, and I'm glad I'm not putting that on somebody. But also, there would be a degree of accountability, I think, on me if there was somebody around. But I've been thinking about it, knowing that we were going to have this conversation. And I think there are two main ways that hoarding can impact couples. One is that one person in the couple hoards, and the other is that both people in a couple hoard. And I've heard of both of those situations many times. And I think both have their own unique challenges, really. So if we look first at couples where one person hoards and the other one doesn't, what kind of tensions and conflicts do you think might arise in that kind of relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, I want to, you know, I think it's so great that you're taking on this topic, because I do think that sometimes it's hard for people to talk about. And there's a lot of shame with, you know, somebody who might be in a relationship with somebody who hoards, and shame about what their home might look like, or, you know, how that reflects on them and their children, or having children's friends over, family over. So it is very, very prevalent. And it's something that, you know, as a therapist, I know everybody's secrets and everybody thinks they're alone. And I know that they're not, because I hear it. So what's so wonderful about a podcast is that we get to just to have these conversations, and who knows, you know, who's listening that might feel a little bit better. So anyway, I want to thank you again for inviting me. I was so excited when I saw your email.
Thank you.
Yeah. So yes. So when I think about couples where one person is a hoarder or has trouble letting go of items, and the other person does not, what tends to happen is there's conflicts about the stuff. There's conflicts about getting rid of stuff. And those conversations are not very productive, because one partner is saying, I need you to throw away stuff. I need you to, here at our neck of the woods, we have green drop, where it's so easy. Just put everything in a bag. We write green drop and they come pick it up. And it's like infuriating that it's not so simple, right? Just put it in the bags. Tell me, here's, you don't need all these books. Pick, you know, of these 50 books, just pick five that you really love, and the rest, you know, somebody else can read. And what happens is then there's a fight around whether we're going to save this book or that book, or what this book means and what that book means. And what I have found as helpful is to have a deeper conversation. So there is a reason that the person who is having trouble letting go of things, there's a reason that there's meaning that they're assigning to either the item, the process of letting go of the item, what it could be, a fear of the future, like am I letting go of a legacy, of what, where that would go, or it could be holding on to the past. And usually the other partner really needs a lot of help and support in understanding that, because it takes time to really structure a dialogue for the couple where I'm helping them slow down and listen a little bit more deeply to not the items itself, but what are the fears that are associated with these items, or also what are the unfulfilled dreams? What do we hope that we'll get from holding on to these things? Or, you know, what if our grandchildren have these, you know, what, like, that's huge, right? Like, and then oftentimes the partner sort of like really having to kind of turn their conceptualization on their head of like what, how they thought of like, this is just a bookcase that's got way too many books on it, to this was something that was your grandfather's. And there's a story behind every single thing. So it's not easy once you have that conversation. But then you've got two people who are solving the same problem instead of two people who are fighting about what the problem is. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. It's that whole thing about the stuff being a symptom rather than the core problem. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, if there's enough stuff, it can become its own problem as well.
Yeah.
But if somebody is keeping something, keeping everything, because they were very poor growing up and they don't believe that they can replace things if they go, then if a partner understands that, they can maybe go through the bank account and say, look, we're doing okay. We have some savings. Sure. We can replace things if they need to. Is it that kind of thing?
Yes. That's a really good example. And first, before you can go to the bank account, it's really feeling understood about the depth of the pain that was felt, you know, growing up, so that there's compassion in the process of looking at the bank account. And so you know, that can be done in a couple different ways. Like, look at how much money we have. We don't, you know, we're not poor. That can be slammed in somebody's face. Or it's, yeah, like, hey, babe, like, look where we are, you know? Another thing that's very, very common is differences in how people were raised and what their home felt like. And so for some people, if there was chaos, if maybe there was addiction in the house and there were wine bottles all over the place, that clutter then represents a lot for that person who maybe wants to get rid of the clutter. It's not just one person. Everybody has their connection to why do they want a clean, clutter-free house? Why? And, you know, or the contempt that they might feel when they see all of this stuff and they see it as disgusting and they have judgment. That judgment is probably coming from somewhere. And so that can be really enlightening when both people are listening to each other, that it doesn't make it seem like, oh, just one person is the person with the problem. That's the, you know, we're going to use hoarder with a capital H as if this is this terrible thing versus a different coping mechanism for a different way of being raised.
That's a really interesting point because, yeah, it's easy to look at that relationship and say all of the problem is with person A.
Yeah.
And person B not only has their own stuff, as you say, but also has a need to be recognized as sometimes as the one who doesn't all have it all together. It's not like the non-hoarder has to be the savior and at all times perfectly functioning. Right. I think both sides of a relationship can fall over once in a while.
Sure. And there might be feelings that need to be honored that non-hoarding person has around the anger, the shame that they might have of their home, that it's okay for them to be angry at their partner. That's what happens when we're in love. And to have that not come across as like one person is wrong and the other person is right, but also that other person was probably, you know, partner A was angry at partner B when they threw away things without asking their opinion. There's a lot of that happens with couples, right? It's like people, like a transparency issue and a trust issue where people will throw things away without talking it to the partner and feeling very justified in doing so. Understandably, right? I mean, I can always see both sides.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. I look at it, even as the hoarder myself, I look at it and have most sympathy in my head for the non-hoarder in this imaginary relationship that I've got, because I am that I've got in my head, because I imagine it being very, very difficult for a lot of reasons. But equally, I expect when addressing things, it's important that the person who hoards doesn't feel like they're making all the compromises.
Right, because then it doesn't feel balanced. You want it to have a relationship to feel healthy and happy, you know, two people who feel like equals, who are both, you know, imperfect humans. And when both experiences are understood, we're more likely to be able to see it through that lens, that there's not a right or a wrong, but there may be a common goal. Right. In terms of like, how do we want our home to be if we are cohabitating, or if we're deciding whether or not we can cohabitate? Do we have a mutual goal here? And then the goal is external. Like, I like to, I'm a big metaphor person, right? That's why I love your airplane thing. Right. But like, it's like a couple can have a goal to get a soccer ball. Oh, you probably call it football, right?
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, in that world anyway.
No, me neither.
Right, but so you've got the ball. You want the ball to go through the net, and so you want to both kick the same ball. But when couples aren't functioning well, they're kicking each other's shins instead of realizing the problem is outside. The problem is not person A or person B. There may be a problem, which is we've got to get this house in better shape, or we have to find a way to honor these belongings in a way that is really is having integrity for the meaning that they represent. So this is a big challenge that we've got to figure out. And when you can shift from you're the problem, or no, I'm not the problem, you're the problem, that's where people are kicking each other's shins and everybody's getting hurt and nobody feels better. Like, you don't feel better when you kick someone else's shins. Like, you think you're going to feel better, but like, even if you win and you're like, you hurt them, you just hurt somebody you love. Like, yeah. I mean, we know that intellectually, but we get stuck into it, you know, trying to blame the other person is natural experience.
Yeah. And if the non-hoarding partner is understandably angry and annoyed, if the hoarding partner, I feel like we should have given them imaginary names.
Right, I know.
If the hoarding partner feels threatened by that anger, they may well react by getting more protective of their stuff, because yes, that's their coping mechanism. That's where they go when things are difficult. And if anger to them is threatening, then everybody doubles down and everybody digs their heels in, well, rather said, than saying, okay, what's actually going on?
Yep. And what is underneath the anger? Anger usually comes with a buddy, right? it's not by itself. There's something there. So if you can understand what's underneath the anger, is it that there's a feeling of peace that comes that you want to have that's connected to your home? And it's like a partner A or whatever. the names of the people in my book are Carson, Jamie and Carson, because I like to use gender neutral names so that you can
like
kind of
that.
Apply whoever.
Yep.
Yeah. Right. So it's like if Jamie's partner hoards, and Jamie's angry about it, but then Carson understands, well, the reason Jamie's angry is because they want to feel proud of their home. They want to feel comfortable. They want to get up and have a cup of coffee in a place that feels like they want to be. And so then it's like, instead of fighting against the anger, it's like, oh, I want Jamie to have that experience. Like, and then we're more motivated to be generous instead of what you're describing so beautifully. Like, that dance you described is like to a T, very, very, very common. And the work is like, how do you get out of defensiveness and into generosity?
I like that. Do you want to be a de-hoarding darling? You can be now at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. If you love the podcast and want a bit extra, you can finally sign up to be a D-Hoarding Darling. Members will get an exclusive monthly post with an additional top tip, some podcast and music recommendations, and a personal update from me about how things are going. Find out the full details at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. So the other imaginary couple, Alex and
Sam,
well done, are both I was really stuck. So our second imaginary couple, Alex and Sam, are both hoarders. So what are the potential pitfalls and conflicts in a relationship like that? Because it happens a lot. I don't know if we might attract each other somehow, or if, I don't know, but yeah.
Well, there's a comfort in right? So there's a belief that you're going to be shamed, and you find out that somebody else struggles with the same thing, then there might be a belief that you're less likely to be shamed by someone else who shares the same struggle. So oftentimes we do look for similarities with our partners.
Yeah.
And I like to talk about sort of apparent similarities, because there's apparent similarities, and then there's, you know, ways in which there are dissimilarities, and, you know, there's differences in the apparent similarities. And so it doesn't matter when you think you have something in common, there's always differences underneath it. Like, you can't find another you. And do you really want another you anyway? Like,
God, no, I can't imagine anyone worse to be in a relationship with.
Oh, no. Don't say that.
I mean, I like myself, but I annoy myself. So.
That's fair. That's totally fair. I can relate. So I think that that the thing about two people who are both struggling with hoarding is that they may, you know, have times where one of them is more motivated to overcome the problem and one of them wants radical acceptance. And then there can be a blame that can happen of who's worse, like this. You know, who's making this problem, you know, not go away. And there might be times where one person, you know, really maybe goes on, makes a big effort to sort through some stuff, and then feeling like their partner, like, pulls them backwards or doesn't support the progress. And then they feel like, why even bother? And that can sadly cause some hopelessness. So, and then there is a sense of, you know, as you talked about the accountability, I do think there's some truth to that, although I don't think it's good to set that up as an expectation, right? No. But there is some truth to the fact, just like you see somebody go out and exercise and you're like, oh, look how healthy, you know, maybe I'm not going to go for a run, but maybe I can go for a walk. And it can kind of help people maybe look at what their version of that might be. But I think that there may be a way in which there's advantages of, you know, having two people together who do understand why it's so difficult and will be able to be more patient and listen to the stories. I mean, some of my couples talk about they just want somebody to hear the story about why I don't want to let go of this photo album. I want to show you who all these pictures are. I want to... I mean, a photo album is a bad idea, probably, because you don't really want to. That's like really high up there in terms of something to get. But like a lamp, you know, a really ugly lamp. You know, whose lamp was that? And what memories do you have of sitting on the floor playing checkers, you know, with where that lamp was in that room? And I think that sometimes people have a higher tolerance for being able to give somebody something that they really understand from them personally, as opposed to trying to understand, but really not having that intrinsic similarity.
It makes me think of couples where both people have an issue with, say, alcohol addiction.
Mm-hmm.
If they are both really enmeshed in drinking and drinking and drinking, it can be a really destructive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But if they are both really working on it, they can be the best support, far better support than somebody who doesn't understand at all.
Well said. You can call somebody out when you've walked the walk and you really know, you've been there and you have more credibility, I think. That's true.
Yeah, it's easy to just imagine Alex and Sam getting together and it being chaos. They just double their hordes with each other. But yeah, I guess it needn't be, especially if ideally both of them are keen to make things different.
Yeah, and supporting each other when they're not different. Like having it be okay if it's too much to make certain changes, that's not dependent on a relationship to work.
You say on your website, and this is actually the title of your book as well, Love is an Action Verb. Mm-hmm. And you say, learn what you can do to feel more connected, communicate more clearly, and have more fun together. And that relates a bit to what we were saying at the beginning. It's important in couples where one or both hoard to not just focus on the difficult, traumatic conflict stuff.
Yes. I had a supervisor that used to say, a one-winged bird cannot fly. You have to focus on the positivity just as much as the negativity, or else you will just be in a dive bomb. A dive bomb? Is that, you know, I'm just picturing one bird going down. Yeah. A downward spiral. And sometimes, you know, if we don't have awareness of all the good stuff that is there, it's a challenge, right? Because finding that positivity, it has to be authentic positivity, or else it will come across as sarcasm or insincerity. So really, truly seeing your partner as lovable and seeing yourself as lovable, probably the harder of the two. Knowing that you're worthy of love, knowing no matter what your shtick is, whether it's hoarding or addiction or, you know, we've all got something.
Haven't we just? Do you ever just prescribe fun for a couple? Just say, go and do something really nice this week.
I do. Timing is important, right? Because if you come in and you're really in a crisis and you've got a therapist that says, talk about what you appreciate about each other, you would just feel like misunderstood, right? If it's like somebody says, go out and just go on a date. Well, we're going to fight on our date. Like, we don't want to. Last time we went on a date, like one person walked home. So it's got to be the timing has to be right so that both people, before they just prescribe the behavior of doing the fun thing, they are connected with an internal mindset first of this person is worth having, you know, celebrating and having fun with. And this person is somebody that I look up to and I see as a wonderful person. And so that once that mindset happens, the Gottmans call it positive sentiment override. And then there's this other thing called negative sentiment override. And when we're in the positive perspective, if somebody does something negative, we can kind of think maybe they're just having a bad day, maybe they're sleep deprived, right? And you kind of think of it as neutral.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're in a negative experience, if somebody does something positive, you assign negative meaning to it. Oh, yes. Like, why do you have to, you know, like you don't get a star for emptying the dishwasher, right? Like,
it's like if one, I always see this on TV, one person comes home with a bunch of flowers and the other one says, what have you done? And I always think just enjoy the flowers.
Yeah. Yeah. And in my, right, I would feel the same way. And then in my couples therapy hat, I would say to myself, okay, what's missing there in that relationship that there's something that there's a negative over, like a filter that a couple is in that they need a little bit of support kind of figuring out how to remember why they fell in love in the first place. And that would be sort of a symptom. I would kind of see that as a little bit of a red flag of like, oof, wait a second, babe, what's going on with you guys? Like,
and indeed, has the partner with the flowers cheated 5 times before and each time come home with flowers afterwards? I guess there's a whole exactly. context, isn't there?
Right. Or did this partner not cheat, but partner A was cheated on in their last relationship and they used to get flowers and they had no idea it was a trigger of like, oh, don't ever get me flowers, dude. Like, get me chocolate. And then you learn that quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think with either of our imaginary couples, even if kind of emotionally things are quite positive, living in hoarded surroundings can make things, can inflame tensions in, like, if you can't sleep properly because the bed isn't clear, or if you can't right. ever sit down and have a meal together because there isn't space, yes. even if all intentions are good, it adds difficulty to a relationship.
Yes. Yes. And it's a very right, like, it's important to look at the gravity of the issue as well, and not just sugarcoat and be like, oh, there's a reason why this, you know, but also, right. And that comes back to the action verb part. Like, also sometimes you got to just roll up your sleeves and do that thing. And once you feel like, okay, we both understand why this is, but we don't want it to be, we're worthy of having a beautiful bed with a right nice bedspread that we like, feel comfy, cozy, and maybe there's like a pile of stuff over there in the corner, but let's make this bed beautiful, let's buy some new sheets, let's, you know, get some fluffy pillows. And I think that's like creating something positive, but also realizing that there's a certain amount of like grit, like we're going to have to do the difficult thing of hanging in there, and there's going to be sadness or emotional difficulty when we put those things out for the, you know, the whatever service you're donating it to, that to be expected, it's going to be hard, makes it a little bit easier to kind of manage it. Whereas if you're not in a place, if you're in a place where somebody's telling you, oh, it's super easy and all you have to do is blah, 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 it's never, ever going to work. But if you're like, yeah, this is hard, like you're running a marathon, you're going to sweat. There's no way that you're going to run a marathon without hurting your legs and getting out of breath. So once you expect it to be hard and honor just how hard that is, then the two people, I think in both couples, both of our imaginary little couples, I think when you know it's hard and you understand why it's hard, then the work is still going to be work. There's no way, like there's no shortcut really. I mean, is that consistent with you? I know it sounds like this is a specialization for you, and I'm wondering if that's consistent with the kind of advice that you might give.
Yeah, it's I was thinking of a couple who say they live together. This is our couple where one hoards and the other doesn't. If it gets to a kind of crisis point, and a starting place could be something like, okay, we're going to clear that corner of that room and that's mm-hmm. going to be yours.
Yeah.
And that's your space. And you as the non-hoarder have that. And that's yes. kind of a placeholder. So I've given something and we've worked something out, but it's a placeholder to get us through the immediate crisis from where we have to do the really deep work, I think.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And I think when it is in a crisis, you know, there that sometimes is a time, you know, if we use the analogy you were using before of an addiction, there might be a time where a partner says, I can't stay here unless you go get the treatment that you need to take care of yourself, because I love you and I see that this is hurting you and it's also hurting me. And I think sometimes that crisis can actually, you know, work as a catalyst to have some positive changes happen.
And if it doesn't work as a catalyst, that person's entitled to leave. And we can't, on the hoarder side of the relationship, resent that. I mean, it would be difficult. I'm not saying it would be easy, but equally, I think somebody who is not a hoarder should not feel obliged to stay if it comes to that crunch point.
Exactly. And that's consistent with what you're saying, is so in line with what I believe around relationships in general, that when you choose a partner, you choose a set of problems that you're going to live with. And I might be able to live with one problem, and you might be able to live with another problem, and there's no judgment. It's just that there's a lid for every pot. And if you convince yourself that you should stay and grill through it, or whatever that word is, like, then it's going to build resentment, and that's not kind. That doesn't feel good to your partner. You're not doing them a favor, because they might find somebody that's like, hey, I can live with that problem for the rest of my life, but not this one, right? Yeah. Who knows what it's going to be?
Yeah, it may be that you couldn't live with somebody with a heroin addiction, but you're okay with something else, or vice versa. It's we've all got our own backstories and preferences as well. It's not all about deep psychological stuff. Sometimes it's just, I briefly dated somebody who took a lot of drugs when we went out, and I just thought, no, that's not what I want. And that's fine.
Yes, exactly. And for me, my version of that was, I need somebody that can talk about their feelings. I teach everybody how to express themselves all day. I need a partner who already knows how to do that. And then there's other things that, like, that was a deal breaker for me. And once I was super clear about that being really, really important, somebody who had that emotional connection capacity, that then I had it in my head, if there were other things, because this person I'm married to is not perfect either, just like myself. And then it's like, I can go back to them and say, yes, but these things that are crucial to me, you know, he has those qualities. And so sometimes it might be that you're focusing on what you want as if you can have everything, but you can't, right? It's like, you know, my husband's not so handy. Like, he cannot build a shed. If we need somebody to build a shed, that's going to either be me, or it's going to be somebody that we hire.
Yeah.
And so, like, so, but if I'm like, oh, if I just focus on, oh, I wish he could do that thing, then I'm forgetting, like, oh, but there's these other things too. And so when you look at what you do have and what you don't have in balance, remembering that you're the same way, you know, I have my faults as well, then it really is a deep, deep sense of acceptance, as opposed to, oh, I'm just putting up with this thing that I don't really like. No, you're choosing to be with that person, knowing their blind spots, or knowing their, you know, what are the skeletons in their closet, you know?
Completely. And it's not that I expect perfection in a relationship. It's that particular thing, it was party drugs. It was overwhelming. I got annoyed. She got out of control. And I thought, no, but I've had other relationships with other difficulties that I've worked with. It's not that everything has to be 100%, is it? It's just that we all have our limits as well. And we might not know them until we come across them. I didn't know I couldn't really tolerate somebody getting so out off the head on a night out until I was faced with it repeatedly. And I just thought, no, I can't.
Right. And now you know that. And it might be that you'd be surprised. You would say, oh, I could never be with somebody who, I don't know, struggles with depression. And then you fall in love with somebody who struggles with depression, and you realize, you know, that you can go the distance with them and learn how to support them and feel closer in part of that, you know, expression and understanding. So it's like, there's so many different things where somebody else might be able to handle, you know, drugs, but not depression, or, you know, expecting somebody to, you know, have a certain kind of job, or be a different, you know, religion, or, you know, political thing. I mean, there's so many things, there's so many boxes that we get to choose. I think we get to choose which are the ones that are the most important to us.
So if a couple has either one or two hoarders, we've talked a bit about one option is maybe to kind of start by creating space for one person or clearing one thing, like you said, like the bed, making the bed perfect and starting from there. What other things can couples do if hoarding is an issue in their relationship?
One thing that's worked with some of the couples that I've helped has been hiring another person. And if there's financial capacity to hire an organizer, the right kind of organizer who can sit with the person and who has experience working with hoarders. There are people who feel joy by helping people through this process. And what that does is it takes the pressure off of the non-hoarding partner to be like, when they're in that space, they can feel so triggered and so angry. But if they go out for the weekend and somebody else, and you're hiring this person who's not in the mix, I've found that sometimes that can help. It can also backfire. It has to be the right person. It can't be somebody that has a like external like method that has to do with bins, or it has to be somebody that's really willing to learn from the hoarder what they already know about themselves. And so as therapists, we, you know, you'd be surprised how common this is, that we actually develop relationships with people in the field. The same way, if you were looking for a referral for a psychiatrist, you would think, oh, of course, you know, I can talk to my therapist about that. But this is a big enough issue, and so many couples have tension about it, that that it's like, I've learned who are the people who really have their heart in it and understand what hoarding is, and then they can help these couples.
Because there really are, there's professional organizers and there's professional organizers. Some are the kind who like to go in and kind of perfect an almost perfect home, you know, make it absolutely efficient or absolutely beautiful. And that's amazing if that's what you need, but it's not what a hoarder needs. And there are also professional organizers at the other end of this kind of spectrum who are a lot more about the process and about understanding what's going on for you, and about it being a dialogue as well. It's important to not get somebody who is making decisions for you.
Oh, right. To make decisions for you, then you just have the same version of the fight that you were having with your partner with an organizer, and you're paying them. So that doesn't work. But what we were saying too about the action, like then once there's the trust there and it's a sense we've honored this lamp, then the organizer can take the lamp and put it in their trunk. And that I think really also helps.
No doubt.
Concrete things. I don't have as much experience where there's two hoarders together. I happen not to have had that on my caseload, but I would imagine that hiring the right organizer could help them as well. I don't know if you have anything maybe to educate me about that.
I don't know. I would imagine so, yes. Or it would depend, I think, on whether the two people had kind of independent hoards within the same home, or whether they were very enmeshed and it was the same stuff. Because if they had two quite independent hoards, Alex has 8 billion books and Sam has 8 billion bottles of shampoo,
right?
Then maybe even two different organizers, one to work with each person, because Alex won't get stressed about the shampoo because that's not her thing. Mm-hmm. And ditto with Sam and the books. But if it's kind of mutual stuff, that is, I would imagine an external person would be really advantageous, but it would be more difficult for that external person because you're kind of negotiating with two people.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's all of that then relationship dynamic that then is happening right in front of this person, because it would probably come out, I would imagine.
Yeah, because both partners would be stressed at the prospect, and that's when they would get more protective of their stuff or get more determined to hold on to things because it's difficult. And how do I cope with difficult?
Yep.
I have a couple of friends who, a couple of years ago, they'd been together for years, and then one of them moved out a couple of years ago because they were having trouble in their relationship. It was, and they wanted to work on it, but they couldn't live together at that point. Mm-hmm. And so one of them moved out and they started having counseling, couples counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And the therapist said, I don't quite know what to do with you because you've come to me quite early in this process and you're both really loving and respectful towards each other and you're not angry at each other. You're just saying, this is difficult. And they fixed things really quite quickly and they've been back together again for years. And
I love a happy ending.
Yeah.
I was holding my breath. Oh, no, wait.
No, everybody was willing them to because they're gorgeous together. But, aww, you know, it was their life. We, you know, we can't say, oh, you've got to get back together because you're really cute. That doesn't work. But basically, it looked like going for help early, even if it bewildered the therapist who was used to getting people at the absolute crisis point where it was all screaming and anger. They think that kind of saved them, really. So I'm thinking with any couple, but with hoarding in particular, you don't have to wait for a crisis, do you?
Oh, I love that you're saying this. I mean, I just, this is my mission. This is my mission to help people ask for help sooner. It's like, if you want to learn how to play tennis, like, go buy your tennis racket and then schedule a lesson. Like, because then you can learn from the experts and you get into good habits from the beginning. You kind of have an agreement. You know what's on the table. You know what your challenges are. And then, you know, you can move forward practicing those skills as opposed to having to go back and unlearn them. Like, oh, wait, my elbow wasn't supposed to be there when I made a serve. Like, that's really hard to learn how to undo it. And so, I think we're getting closer. I do think that there's less shame about going to therapy. I think that this mental health crisis has turned people's attention to the benefit of having, you know, a therapist in your life. And I'm so happy that more and more people are coming out earlier and asking for help. With the hoarding situation, I would imagine too, it's like, then you have this issue and you still are in a place where maybe you don't have some other life challenges. So you can come up with a mechanism for knowing in advance, this is a challenge. The same way maybe a couple who had a, you know, different relationship would say, okay, a different religion would need to think, okay, how are we going to approach this? Is this going to work? Let's be proactive about it.
I think America is several years ahead of the UK in normalizing therapy.
Okay. Thanks for letting me know.
Yeah. I think we're getting there. I recognize, I see public figures talk about having had therapy now, which even 5 years ago, you never saw. But, you know, it's not, you know, just a comedian will say, oh, when I saw my therapist the other day. So it's not even just people who talk about mental health, but it's just becoming more normal and less weird to see a therapist. But I think America is further ahead than we are because we have all this kind of stiff upper lip nonsense that, you know, we're meant to be very controlled and not led by our emotions and all of that.
And so maybe that, you know, maybe the entree is more of these other ways of getting information, listening to podcasts, reading books. You know, I'm on TikTok. Unbelievable. Like, like how many people are wanting certain information, and it's a safe way to just get this information on your phone without having to ask for help. And it's also accessibility is an issue. Therapy is expensive. And therapy with an expert, right? Like the more training somebody has, the higher those fees are, the harder it is to get an appointment. And so, you know, maybe it's not that everybody has to go to therapy. Maybe it's finding other avenues and creative ways to educate yourself earlier on in the process before you need to spend that kind of money.
Yeah. Or even just a really good book that you both relate to that helps people work through relationship difficulties. I think there's, and yeah, TikTok is incredible. It's really dangerous if you don't want to waste an hour of your day, but because it's very addictive. But the openness about certain things, the number of people who are, in this country at least, getting ADHD diagnoses because they found out on TikTok about the symptoms, especially mm-hmm. for women, because and autism as well, because it can present a bit differently in women and the symptoms in men are more well known. People are going on TikTok and saying, oh, I didn't know that was a symptom. I do that. And then another thing and another thing. And they start to think, and then they do the research and then they go to the doctor. And yeah, it's incredible.
Really is. It's there's something very powerful about just how unassuming it is to see just a person in their living room telling you what they know because they've been working with people with ADHD, or they've been, you know, it could be anything. And I have found that people are very, very hungry to learn from, you know, some of the more evidence-based approaches and what I feel very honored in that situation that, like, here I am, this old lady, like, you know, just with my little iPhone. But I really feel like there's a deference of like, okay, we have a lot to learn. And so maybe young people get a bad rap, but that's not been my experience at all, that they want this information. They try it. They go home. They thank me. They're very positive. So,
yeah, absolutely. And while there's no, whenever I do this podcast and whatever I'm talking about, there's never going to be one thing that helps everybody, because everybody's situation is different and everybody's got to this point from, you know, for a million different reasons. But from what you're saying, and correct me if this is wrong, but it sounds like it's not just important to keep communication open, but also a kind of openness to learning, which relates to what we were just saying about TikTok, that it's not just about listening and speaking. It's about being willing to change as well, not just in terms of the stuff around you, but anyway. And that's unsettling for people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what you're talking about is humility and curiosity. Yeah. Which, when you put it out there and you have positive experiences where people hold you in your vulnerability, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. Because if you let yourself be vulnerable and that is treated respectfully and lovingly, that's a really powerful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a terrifying thing, but a powerful thing.
Sure. I talk about it in terms of testing the waters, right? Don't do a deep sea dive with somebody that you just met, but like think about it in terms of going into a cold ocean where you put your feet in and it's cold, but then you kind of get used to it and you're comfortable, and then you can go, it can go in a little bit deeper if it feels okay and you feel comfortable. But also if it's too much, you can just back out. And I think that's about testing how much do you trust the person with whom you're being vulnerable and how are they receiving you?
Yeah. Have they earned that trust as well? It's mm-hmm. We can't, unfortunately, always expect the best and always expect perfection from people. because we all screw up and we all get it wrong sometimes in boring day-to-day ways and sometimes in ways, I know I've done it. You look back and you think, I really let that person down in that moment with that thing I said because I was tired or I was frustrated or I didn't know what to say. That's often been the thing with me. If I look back at kind of difficult moments in a relationship where I've said something, say, insensitive, it's not been, I want to hurt this person. It's not been, I don't care. It's been, I have no idea what to say. And so I fill the silence and something comes out of my mouth because I don't want the silence. And afterwards I go, that was the wrong thing to say. So about even when things go wrong, not always kind of looking at the worst of somebody.
Sure. Sure. It's like what I was saying before about repair. You know, hey, like, can I say that again? That did not come out right. Yeah. You know, and giving one another some grace with that of like, you know, just like, can I, that thing I said yesterday, that was insensitive. And that takes courage, right? Because it's not easy to initiate that dialogue when maybe that person has moved on and they're not angry at you and you're having a great time. Why do you want to bring up that conversation? But it's worth it because it's lingering in you if you feel bad about not being your best self. And it also then, you know, had an impact on the other person, even if they're not actively showing you. So so when we can get into that habit of trusting each other and being and going back, and I call it a redo. You can always have a redo. You know, I mess up as a therapist. Wait, did I get you? Did I misunderstand you? I was totally off, you know, we all do it.
And I'm thinking you can have that redo. It doesn't have to be immediate. It's a few years ago now, but got a message on Facebook. You know, when Facebook was new and we were finding everybody from school who we hadn't been in contact with for decades. Uh-huh. And suddenly... And there are people who you have no, you don't remember them at all, but you see that all your mutual friends are also from school. So you think, oh, they must have been from, and you add all kinds. I did all kinds of people. And I got a message from somebody who said, I was really horrible to you at school and I felt bad about it and I'm so sorry. And it was an interesting experience because she was really horrible to me at school and it wasn't a massive trauma in my life, but I'd held on to it to some degree. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I think made it a lot easier to receive that message was that she made clear that by saying that she wasn't expecting anything from me.
Right.
She wasn't saying, so do you forgive me? Or please reply and tell me it's okay. She said, you know, I'm saying this because it's important for me to say it. I hope that me saying this doesn't make things more difficult for you. And I don't expect anything in return, but I just needed to say it.
Wow.
And it was powerful. And it wasn't a fully positive experience because it dredged things up.
Sure.
But overall, it was still an incredible thing for her to do, a brave thing for her to do, and something that, especially with a bit of distance, I really appreciate.
Mm.
And so we can say, do you know, when we first got together or when we first got married, I said something and it's sat with me ever since because it wasn't kind or it wasn't understanding. And I apologized to my mum recently for something I'd done when I was a small child that I'd felt guilty about for 40 years and she didn't even remember. I'm so sorry for that time I did this thing. I had really upset her at the time and yet she had no memory of this at all. But I needed to say it. But if you, I'm sorry I'm going on here, but
no.
If you're the person apologizing or correcting yourself, I think there's two aspects to it. One is doing it is hard. But I do think this thing of not asking or assuming that you're going to get something in return is quite important. Otherwise, you're just putting it on them and they haven't invited it.
Well said. Well said. Or if you bring it up as sort of, I feel really bad about how I treated you in high school, that would have felt very different to you, right? Because then here you are, this person mistreated you, and then they're kind of making a bid for you to take care of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Or say, oh, it's fine. Don't worry. No.
Right. But what a beautiful example of how to do it in a way that really is one-sided, taking accountability and being in integrity with the kind of person you want to be just because you're in the world, not because you expect something back.
Yeah.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad that she reached out to you, or they reached out to you.
Yeah. If you'd asked me to list like the top 20 awful things about being a teenager, she probably wouldn't have made the list. But when it came up, I realized it was still there, even if it wasn't something I particularly thought about very much. So I think there's a value. But yeah, it, from that side of things, it makes you vulnerable. If I had apologized to my mum for that thing I did when I was 5, and she had said, yeah, that was really cruel of you, or yeah, that made me feel horrible, I would have heard that, but it would have made it hard as well.
Sure.
You need to be prepared for whatever comes back if you're the one trying to make amends.
If you're inviting a dialogue, right, then you're inviting a dialogue. And that's why it's so brave to be able to hold your own truth and also the other person's truth in the dialogue.
So if we have a couple where either one or both hoard, what would you say are some good first steps? Say 3 things that are not universally applicable, but quite often useful in that situation.
So I think that number one is owning the issue on the front end, like being able to bring something forward as, this is part of who I am, part of what I struggle with, and I just want you to know that I'm aware of it. By bringing it forward like that, you are less likely to have it feel like this other person then thinks that you don't know it's an issue, and that they feel like it's on them to kind of bring it to your attention. And it also shows the other person that you have self-awareness, and that's always a good thing. I think, in my opinion, in my life.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Some might disagree, but that's what I think. So I would say one thing is owning it. And number two is being open to hearing how that other person receives the information, right? So being curious, how is that for you? Do you have concerns about it? And having a dialogue, if there's, you know, what is stuff, you know, represent to you, and how would you feel about that? And then number three would be, I would say, you know, to think about being very deliberate if in the decision of cohabitation, if that were to happen, how would that happen? And to not just end up in it because you've been spending the night and then the next thing you know, you've got your toothbrush or whatever. Yeah. Like, I would say, make it overt, like this is something that we need to talk about, and be proactive with coming up with a plan.
Yeah.
So that's it off the top of my head.
That's impressive. I like it. You know what you're talking about.
Oh, you're very kind.
So if people want to find you online, find out what you're up to, where can they do that?
So thank you. Thank you for that invitation. I've got my website is laurasilverstein.co. It's C-O, not C-O-M. So that's not me misspeaking. laurasilverstein.co. And I have a couple exciting things coming up. I have a workbook that's about to be published. My goal is, in the U.S., Valentine's Day is a big deal.
Same here. Yeah.
Is it there too? Okay. I have mixed feelings with it about it, but I do think people have, you know, love on their mind. So my goal is to get it published the beginning of February. And I currently have a book out called Love is an Action Verb. And that is very much of a practical how-to guide of what you can do proactively, or what you might learn in couples therapy that you can do without a couples therapist. So there's certain things that you can't do, trauma or betrayal work in a paperback book, but the communication skills, intimacy, friendship, fun, that's the stuff that I teach all my couples. And I feel like much more comfortable putting that in writing. So that's Love is an Action Verb. That's on Amazon. If you want to be on my mailing list and find out about the workbook, then you can go to my website, and there's a bunch of freebies you can download. So choose your freebie and they'll all get you on my mailing list, and then you'll get a discount, you know, when the book comes out. I'm also a TikTok, which is Laura's Love Advice.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
And I will link to all of those in the show notes. So if you're kind of scrambling for a pen and can't find one, you just find it all on the website where it always is. Laura, thank you so much. That's been really, really useful. Even as somebody not in a relationship, I'm feeling quite inspired. So it's brilliant. Yeah. Thank you.
I thank you. What a riveting conversation. I just feel like we could keep talking for another 3 hours, and we're just like ping-ponging back and forth. And it's so wonderful to talk to somebody who shares, you know, a passion in all things, you know, health and mental health and open, honest communication. So I am so grateful that you found me online somehow and invited me. I'm honored. And let's do this again sometime. We can take on a different aspect of the topic, because I think it's so important, and I appreciate you taking this on.
Absolutely. I would be up for that.
Do you have any burning questions you'd love me to answer? I'll get to the top tip in a second, but my first Q&A episode was really popular, so I'm going to be open to questions on a rolling basis. And then when I have enough, I'll make another episode answering them. Contact me on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, Reddit, YouTube, or plain old email. All the links are on my website at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Ask me anything and I will do my best to answer it. Now, your top tip.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People, on Broadway through June 16th only.
Burrow sofas are built for the way you live. With thousands of possible configurations, their five-seating collections fit any decor, from classic mid-century style to sleek contemporary design. Burrow sofas are made to last and grow with you. You can add seats whenever and easily assemble your updated sofa with no tools needed. And free shipping always? That's just the cherry on top. Right now, save up to 50% during Burrow's spring sale at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
So my top tip this week comes from the Martin Lewis podcast, which, as always, I will link to in the show notes. Now, he's talking in pounds and pence, but whatever currency you have, I'm sure you can make this apply. Have a listen.
I should also use this opportunity to tell everybody about a really good way, if you're short of cash, to help you save. People have been doing this one for years. There's a whole community on my forum that do it. It's called the 1p challenge. And if you've started a few days late, it's fine. What you do is you put away a penny on the 1st of January, 2 pence on the 2nd of January, 3 pence on the 3rd of January, 4 pence on the 4th of January, 5 pence on the 5th of January. If I keep doing this, it will be a very long show. And you keep adding a penny. It'll
be a very long podcast.
Keep adding a penny all the way through the year until the last day of the year, you're putting in £3.65. If you do that at the end of the year, you will have saved 668 quid. And that's the 1p challenge. So just try saving that a penny more each day throughout the year. And what it means is, when you're struggling a bit in January after Christmas, you're not putting so much away and you're putting more away later in the year. Of course, not everybody can do it. Of course, times are tough. Of course, putting any money away is very difficult for people. But if you struggle to make yourself save the small amounts, try that little game And if you need it in the middle of the year, you need it. So use the money. But if you can possibly avoid it, many people love the 1p challenge.
So it may be that you want to save a cent a day rather than a penny a day or whatever your currency is. But it sounds a bit ridiculous, doesn't it, to start by saving 1p today and 2p tomorrow. But that's a big amount at the end of the year. And especially if you're a bit of an overspender, could be a good challenge to set yourself. All right. Thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at ThatHoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with ThatHoarder. To find out more about how you can support this podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to this podcast so you make sure you don't miss any future episodes.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Kim Holderness.
And I'm Ben Holderness.
We host the Holderness Family Podcast every Tuesday.
You may know us from the silly videos that we make online.
Or a book about marriage called Everybody Fights.
Or as winners of season 33 of The Amazing Race.
Still can't believe that happened. Listen, we do a lot of stuff, but our podcast is our most favorite thing.
Yeah, because every week we get to sit down face to face, talk to each other about marriage, family, mental health, or just anything that we want to know more about.
Sometimes we have expert interviews, sometimes it's just us, but our goal is to bring some joy and laughter and to your life every week.
Our other goal is that maybe you will learn something as well.
Right. So search the Holderness Family Podcast and check out our most recent episodes. We have one about staying organized with creators of The Home Edit.
And one about being diagnosed with ADHD as an adult.
We hope you'll join us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.